they align themselves with the atoms in his. It's the way I knew he was still in the lobby earlier today. He kisses the center of my palm again, and I sigh. Touching him is order and chaos, like being assembled and disassembled at the same time.
"You said you had good news,"
he says. I read the hope on his wide-open face. What if it hadn't worked out? How would we have survived being torn apart? Because it feels impossible now, the idea that we don't belong together. But then, I think, of course we would have survived. Separation is not fatal. Still, I'm glad we don't have to find out. The lawyer says he thinks he can figure it out. He thinks I'll get to stay, I say.
How sure is he?
He asks. Surprisingly, he's more skeptical than I am. Don't worry, he seemed pretty sure, I say, and let my happy tears fall. For once, I'm not embarrassed to be crying.
You see, he says, we're meant to be. Let's go celebrate.
He pulls me in close. I tug the tie out of his hair and run my fingers through it. He buries his hands in mine and leans in to kiss me, but I put my finger against his lips to stop him. Hold that kiss, I say. It occurs to me that there's one call I want to make. It's a silly impulse, but Daniel's almost got me believing in meant to be. This entire chain of events was started by the security guard who delayed me this morning. If it weren't for her fondling my stuff, then I wouldn't have been late. There'd have been no Lester Barnes, no Attorney Fitzgerald, no Daniel. I dig around my backpack and pull out Lester Barnes's business card. My call goes straight to voicemail. I leave a rambling message thanking him for helping me and asking him to thank the security guard for me. She has long brown hair and sad eyes, and she touches everyone's stuff, I say, as a way to describe her. Just before I hang up, I remember her name. I think her name is Irene. Please tell her thanks for me. Daniel gives me a quizzical look. I'll explain later, I tell him, and scoop my way back into his arms. Back to Noribang? I ask against his lips. My heart is trying to escape my body through my chest.
No, he says. I have a better idea.
Want to know something crazy? I ask as I lead her back into the building. My interview appointment is here too. No way, she says, and stops walking briefly. I grin at her, dying to know how her scientific brain is going to deal with this epic level of coincidence. What are the odds? She laughs at me. Enjoying yourself, are you? You see, I've been right all day. We were meant to meet. If we hadn't met earlier, maybe we would have met now. My logic is completely refutable, but she doesn't refute me. Instead, she slips her hand into mine and smiles. I may make a believer out of her yet. My plan is to get us to the roof so that we can make out in privacy. We sign in for my appointment at the security desk. The guard directs us to the elevator banks. The one we get on must be the local, because it stops at practically every floor. Suited people get on and off, talking loudly about very important things. Despite what Natasha said earlier, I can never work in a building like this. Finally, we get to the top floor. We get off, find a stairwell, and walk up one flight and straight into a locked gray door with a no roof access sign. I refuse to believe it. Clearly, the roof is just behind these doors. I turn the handle, hoping for a miracle, but it's locked. I rest my forehead against the sign. "Open sesame," I say to the door. Magically, it opens. What the hell? I stumble forward, right into the same security guard from the lobby. Unlike us, he must have taken an express elevator.
You kids aren't allowed up here, he grunts.
He smells like cigarette smoke. I pull Natasha through the doorway with me.
We just wanted to see the view,
I say, in my most respectful, with just a hint of pleading, but non-whining voice. He raises skeptical eyebrows and starts to say something, but a coughing fit overtakes him until he's hunched over and thumping his heart with his fist.
Are you okay?
Natasha asks. He's only bent slightly now, both hands on his thighs. Natasha puts a hand on his shoulder.
Got this cough, he says between coughs.
Well, you shouldn't smoke, she tells him. He straightens and wipes his eyes.
You sound like my wife.
She's right, she says, not missing a beat.
I try to give her a look that says, don't argue with the old security guard with the lung problem, otherwise he won't let us stay up here and make out. But even if she interpreted my facial expression correctly, she ignores me. I used to be a candy striper in a pulmonary ward. That cough does not sound good. We both stare at her. I, because I'm picturing her in a candy striper outfit and then picturing her out of it. I'm pretty sure this is going to be my new nighttime fantasy. I don't know why he's staring at her. Hopefully not for the same reason.
Give them to me,
she says, holding out her hand for his pack of cigarettes. You need to stop smoking. I don't know how she manages to sound so genuinely concerned and bossy at the same time. He pulls the pack out of his jacket pocket.
You think I haven't tried?
He asks. I look at him again. He's too old to be doing this job. He looks like he should be retired and spoiling his grandkids somewhere in Florida. Natasha keeps holding out her hand until he hands over the pack.
Be careful of this one, he says to me, smiling.
Yes, sir. He puts his jacket on.
How do you know I won't just go get some more?
He asks her. I guess I don't, she says, shrugging. He looks at her for a long moment.
Life doesn't always go the way you plan, he says.
I can see that she doesn't believe him. He can see it too, but he lets it go.
Stay away from the edge, he says, winking at both of us. Have a good time.
Joe, A Planned History. The girl reminded him a little of his Beth, direct but sweet. That, more than anything, is why he let them stay up on the roof. He knows perfectly well that the only view they'll be looking at is each other. No harm in that, he thinks. He and his Beth were the same way, and not just at the beginning of their marriage, but all throughout. They won the lottery with each other, they like to say. Beth died last year, 6 months after they'd both retired. In fact, the cancer diagnosis came the day after retirement. They had so many plans. Alaskan cruise to see the Aurora Borealis, hers. Venice to drink grappa and see the canals, his. That's the thing that gets to Joe even now. All the plans they'd made. All the saving. All the waiting around for the perfect time. And for what? For nothing. The girl is right, of course. He shouldn't smoke. After he lost Beth, he took himself out of retirement and took up smoking again. What did it matter if he worked himself to death? What did it matter if he smoked himself to death? There was nothing left to live for, nothing left to plan for. He takes one last look at the girl and the boy before closing the door. They're looking at each other like there's nowhere else they'd rather be. He and his Beth were like that once. Maybe he will give up smoking after all. Maybe he'll make some new plans.
Daniel walks to the edge of the roof and looks out at the city. His hair is loose and blowing in the breeze, and he's got his poet face on. The non-bruised side of his face smiles. I go to him and slip my hand into his. "Aren't you going to write something down, poet boy?" I tease. He smiles wider, but doesn't turn to look at me.
"It looks so different from up here, doesn't it?"
he asks. What does he see when he looks out? I see miles of rooftops, most of them empty. A few of them are populated with long-abandoned things, non-working HVAC units, broken office furniture. Some have gardens, and I wonder who tends them. Daniel takes out his notebook now, and I move a little closer to the edge. Before these buildings were buildings, they were just the skeletons of them. Before they were skeletons, they were crossbeams and girders, metal and glass and concrete. And before that, they were construction plans. Before that, architectural plans. And before that, just an idea someone had for the making of a city. Daniel puts away his notebook and pulls me back from the edge. He puts his hands on my waist. "What do you even write in there?" I ask.
"Plans," he says.
His eyes are merry and staring at my lips, and I'm having trouble thinking. I take a little step back, but he follows, like we're dancing. Jesus, have you been this sexy the whole day?" I ask. He laughs and blushes.
"I'm glad you think I'm sexy."
His eyes are still on my lips. "Is it gonna hurt if I kiss you?" I ask him.
"It'll be a good pain."
He puts his other hand on my waist like he's anchoring us. My heart just will not settle down. Kissing him can't be as good as I remember. When we had our first kiss, I thought I was kissing him for the last time. I'm sure that made it more intense. This kiss will be more normal. No fireworks and chaos, just two people who like each other a lot, kissing. I get on my tiptoes and move in even closer. Finally, his eyes meet mine. He moves his hand from my waist and places it over my heart. It beats under his palm like it's beating for him. Our lips touch, and I try to keep my eyes open for as long as possible. I try not to succumb to the crazy entropy of this thing between us. I don't understand it. Why this person? Why Daniel and not any of the boys before? What if we hadn't met? Would I have had a perfectly ordinary day and not know that I was missing something? I wrap my arms around his neck and lean into him, but I can't get close enough. The restless, chaotic feeling is back. I want things that I can name and some things that I can't. I want this one moment to last forever, but I don't want to miss all the other moments to come. I want our entire future together, but I want it here and now. I'm slightly overwhelmed and break the kiss. "Go. Over there," I say, and punctuate each word with a kiss. I point to a spot far away from me, out of kissing range.
"Here?"
he asks, taking a single step back. "At least five more." He grins at me, but complies. "All our kisses aren't going to be like that, are they?" I ask him.
"Like what?"
"You know, insane."
"I love how direct you are," he says.
"Really? My mom says I go too far."
"Maybe. I still love it, though."
I lower my eyes and don't respond. "How much time until your interview?" I ask.
40 minutes.
Got any more of those love questions for me?
You're not in love with me yet?
His voice is filled with mock incredulity. Nope, I say, and smile at him.
Don't worry, he says. We've got time.
It feels like a miracle that we get to sit here on this rooftop, like we're part of a secret sky city. The sun is slowly retreating across the buildings, but it's not dark yet. It will be soon, but for now there's only an idea of darkness. Natasha and I are sitting cross-legged against the wall next to the stairwell door. We're holding hands, and she's resting her head on my shoulder. Her hair is soft against the side of my face. Are you ready for the dinner guest question yet? I ask. You mean who I'd invite?
Yep.
Ugh, no. You go first, she says.
Easy, I say.
God. She raises her head from my shoulder to look at me. You really believe in God?
I do.
One guy in the sky with superpowers. Her disbelief isn't mocking, just investigative.
Not exactly like that, I say.
What then? I squeeze her hand. You know the way we feel right now? This connection between us that we don't understand and we don't want to let go of? That's God.
Holy hell, she exclaims. You poet boys are dangerous.
She pulls my hand into her lap and holds it with both of hers. I tilt my head back and watch the sky, trying to pick shapes out of the clouds. Here's what I think, I say. I think we're all connected, everyone on Earth. She runs her fingertips over my knuckles.
Even the bad people?
Yes, but everyone has at least a little good in them.
Not true, she says.
Okay, I concede. But everyone has done at least one good thing in their lifetime. Do you agree with that? She thinks it over and then slowly nods. I go on. I think all the good parts of us are connected on some level. The part that shares the last double chocolate chip cookie, or donates to charity, or gives a dollar to a street musician, or becomes a candy striper, or cries at Apple commercials, or says, I love you, or I forgive you. I think that's God. God is the connection of the very best parts of us.
And you think that connection has a consciousness? She asks.
Yeah. And we call it God. She laughs a quiet laugh.
Are you always so erudite?
I ask, interrupting. She laughs louder now. I was gonna say cheesy. Yes, I'm known far and wide for my cheesiness.
I'm kidding, she says, bumping her shoulder into mine. I really like that you've thought about it.
And I have, too. This is not the first time I've had these thoughts, but it's the first time I've really been able to articulate them. Something about being with her makes me my best self. I pull her hand to my lips and kiss her fingers. What about you? I ask. You don't believe in God?
I like your idea of it. I definitely don't believe in the fire and brimstone one.
But you believe in something. She frowns, uncertain.
I really don't know. I guess I'm more interested in why people feel like they have to believe in God. Why can't it just be science? Science is wondrous. The night sky? Amazing. The inside of a human cell? Incredible. Something that tells us we're born bad and that people use to justify all their petty prejudices and awfulness? I don't know. I guess I believe in science. Science is enough.
Huh, I say. Sunlight reflects off the buildings, and the air around us takes on an orange tinge. I feel cocooned even in this wide-open space. She says, "Did you know that the universe is approximately 27% dark matter?" I did not know that, but of course she does. "What is dark matter?" The light is the only word for the look on her face. She tugs her hand out of mine, rubs her palms together, and settles in to explain. "Well, scientists aren't exactly sure, but it's the difference between an object's mass and the mass calculated by its gravitational effect." She raises her eyebrows expectantly, as if she's said something profound and earth-shattering. I am profoundly un-earth-shattered. She sighs, dramatically. "Poets," she mutters, but with a smile. "Those two masses should be the same." She raises an explanatory finger. "They should be the same, but they're not, for very large bodies like planets." "Oh, that's interesting," I say, really meaning it. "Isn't it?" She's beaming at me, and I'm really a goner for this girl. "Also, it turns out the visible mass of a galaxy doesn't have enough gravity to explain why it doesn't fly apart." I shake my head to let her know I don't understand. She goes on. "If we calculate the gravitational forces of all the objects we can detect, it's not enough to keep galaxies and stars in orbit around each other. There has to be more matter that we can't see. Dark matter." "Okay, I get it," I say. She gives me skeptical eyes. "No, really," I say. "I get it. Dark matter is 27% of the universe, you said?" "Approximately. And it's the reason why objects don't hurtle themselves off into deep dark space? It's what keeps us bound together?" Her skepticism turns into suspicion. "What is your addled poet brain getting at?" "You're gonna hate me." "Maybe," she agrees. "Dark matter is love. It's the attracting force." "Oh, God, Jesus, no, yuck, blech, you're the worst." "Oh, I am good," I say, laughing hard. "The absolute worst," she says. But she leans in and laughs hard along with me. "I'm totally right," I say, triumphant. I recapture her hand. She groans again, but I can tell she's thinking about it. Maybe she doesn't disagree as much as she thinks she does. I scroll through the questions on my phone. Okay, I have another one. Complete the following sentence. "We're both in this room feeling dot dot dot." "Like I have to pee," she says, smiling. "You really hate talking about serious things, don't you?" "Have you ever had to pee really bad?" she asks. "It's a serious thing. You could cause serious damage to your bladder by..." "Do you really have to pee?" I ask. "No." "Answer the question," I tell her. I'm not letting her joke her way out of this one. "You first," she says, sighing. "Happy, horny, and hopeful." "Alliteration. Nice." "Your turn, and you have to be sincere," I tell her. She sticks her tongue out at me. "Confused? Scared?" I pull her hand into my lap. "Why are you scared?" "It's been a long day. This morning I thought I was being deported. I've been gearing myself up for that for 2 months. Now it looks like I'll get to stay." She turns to look at me. "And then there's you. I didn't know you this morning, and now I don't really remember not knowing you. It's all a little much. I feel out of control." "Why is that so bad?" I ask. "I like to see things coming. I like to plan ahead." "And I get it. I really do. We are programmed to plan ahead. It's part of our rhythm. The sun rises every day and defers to the moon every night. Like the security guard said, though, planning doesn't always work. Do you think that's true? I think mostly you can plan. Mostly things don't just come out of nowhere and bowl you over. Probably the dinosaurs thought that too, and look what happened to them, I tease. Her smile is so broad that I have to touch her face. She turns her face into my palm and kisses it. Extinction-level events notwithstanding, I think you can plan ahead, she says. I bowled you over, I remind her, and she doesn't deny it. Anyway, I say, so far you only have two things, confused and scared. All right, all right. I'll give you what you want and say happy. I sigh dramatically. You could have said that one first. I like suspense, she says. No, you don't. You're right. I hate suspense. Happy because of me, I ask. And not being deported, but mostly you. She pulls our joined hands to her lips and kisses mine. I could stay here forever interrupting our talking with kissing, interrupting our kissing with talking. When are we doing the staring into each other's eyes thing? I ask. She rolls the very eyes that I want to stare into. Later, after your interview, she says. Don't be scared, I tease. What's to be scared of? All you'll see is iris and pupil. The eyes are the windows to the soul, I counter. Stuff and nonsense, she says. I check the time on my phone unnecessarily. I know it's almost time for my interview, but I want to linger out here in Sky City some more. Let's get in a couple more questions, I say. Lightning round. What's your most treasured memory? The first time I got to eat ice cream in a cone instead of in a cup, she says with no hesitation. How old were you? 4. Chocolate ice cream while wearing an all-white Easter Sunday dress. Whose idea was that? I ask. My father's, she says, smiling. He used to think I was the greatest thing ever. And he doesn't anymore? No, she says. I wait for her to continue, but she moves on. What's your memory? We took a family trip to Disney World when I was 7. Charlie really wanted to go on Space Mountain, but my mom thought it'd be too scary for me, and she wouldn't let him go by himself. And neither of my parents wanted to go. She tightens her grip on my hands, which is cute since I clearly survived the experience. So what happened? I convinced my mom that I really wasn't scared. I told her I'd been looking forward to the ride since forever. But you weren't? She asks. No, I was scared shitless. I just did it for Charlie. She bumps my shoulder and teases. I already like you. You don't have to convince me that you're a saint. That's the thing. I wasn't being saintly. I think I knew our relationship wasn't going to last. I was just trying to convince him I was worth it. It worked, too. He told me I was brave, and he let me finish all his popcorn. I tilt my head back and look up at the clouds. They're barely moving across the sky. Do you think it's funny that both of our favorite memories are about the people we like the least now? I ask. Maybe that's why we dislike them, she says. The distance between who they were and who they are is so wide, we have no hope of getting them back. Maybe, I say. You know what the worst part of that story is? What? I hate roller coasters to this day because of that trip. She laughs, and I laugh with her.
Eyes. An evolutionary history. Scientists theorize that the first eyes were nothing more than a pigmented, light-sensitive spot on the skin of some ancient creature. That spot gave it the ability to sense light from dark, an advantage, since darkness could indicate that a predator was close enough to block out light. Because of this, they survived more, reproduced more, and passed this ability down to their offspring. Random mutations created a deepening depression in the light-sensitive spot. This depression led to slightly better vision, and therefore, more survival. Over time, that light-sensitive spot evolved to become the human eye. How did we go from eyes as a survival mechanism to the idea of love at first sight? Or the idea that eyes are the windows to the soul? Or to the cliché of lovers staring endlessly into each other's eyes? Studies have shown that the pupils of people who are attracted to each other dilate from the presence of dopamine. Other studies suggest that threads in the eye can indicate personality tendencies, and that maybe eyes are a kind of window to the soul after all. And what about the lovers who spend hours staring into each other's eyes? Is it a display of trust? I will let you in close and trust you not to hurt me while I'm in this vulnerable position. And if trust is one of the foundations of love, perhaps the staring is a way to build or reinforce it. Or maybe it's simpler than that. A simple search for connection. To see. To be seen.
Attorney Fitzgerald's door is at the end of a long, gray, and mostly featureless hallway. I try and fail not to take this as a sign about my future. There's no name on the door, just a number. No one answers when I knock. Maybe he's left for the day already, because that would be ideal. Then it wouldn't be my fault that I didn't get to go to Yale and become a doctor. Never mind that I'm 10 minutes late because of all the kissing. I regret nothing. I turn the handle and walk right into a sobbing woman. She's not even crying into her hands to hide her face like people usually do. She's standing in the middle of the room, taking huge gulps of air with tears streaming down her face. Her mascara is streaked across her cheeks and her eyes are puffy and red, like she's been crying for a long time. When she realizes that I'm standing there, she stops crying and wipes her face with the back of her hands. The wiping makes it worse, so now mascara is across her nose, too. "Are you okay?" I ask, asking the dumbest question I can think of. Clearly, she's not okay.
"I'm fine," she says.
She chews on her bottom lip and tries to smooth her hair, but again, she makes the problem worse.
"You're Daniel Bay," she says. "You're here for the admission interview."
I take a step toward her. "Can I get you a glass of water or a tissue or something?" I spy an empty box of Kleenex on her desk next to a "paralegals do it cheaper" mug.
"I'm completely fine. He's just through there," she says, pointing to a door behind her.
"Are you sure you're..." I begin, but she cuts me off.
"I have to go now. Tell him that he's the most wonderful person I've ever met, but that I have to go."
I say, "Okay," even though I won't be telling him any of that. Also, it's a pretty small office. He's probably already heard her declaration. She walks back to her desk and picks up the paralegal's mug.
"And tell him that I want to stay, but I can't. It's better for both of us."
Then she starts crying again. And now I can feel my own eyes welling up with tears. Not cool. She stops crying abruptly and stares at me.
"Are you crying?" she asks.
I wipe my eyes. "It's just a stupid thing that happens to me. I start crying when I see other people crying."
"That's really sweet."
Now that it's not drowning in tears, her voice is kind of musical. "It's kind of a pain in the ass, actually."
"Language," she says, frowning.
"Sorry." What kind of person objects to an innocent word like ass? She accepts my sorry with a slight nod.
We just moved into this office, and now I'll never see it again.
She sniffles and then wipes her nose.
If I'd known how this would end, I would never have started.
Everyone wants to be able to predict the future, I say. Her eyes fill with tears again, even as she's nodding her agreement.
When I was a little girl, fairy tales were my favorite books because even before you opened them, you knew how they were going to end. Happily ever after.
She glances at the closed door behind her, closes her eyes, and opens them again.
In the fairy tales, the princess never does the wrong thing.
The office door behind me opens. I turn, curious to see what the most wonderful person in the world looks like. Except for the bandage over his right eye, he looks pretty normal.
Daniel Bay?
He asks, looking only at me. His eyes don't flit over to her for even a second. I hold out my hand for a shake.
Mr. Fitzgerald, it's nice to meet you.
He doesn't shake my hand.
You're late,
he says, and walks back into his office. I turn to say goodbye to the secretary, but she's already gone.
I take my phone out of my backpack. Still no return call or text from Bev. Maybe she's on another tour. I remember she said she wanted to make it to University of California, San Francisco, too. I should call my mom. Probably I should have called her at many points today. She's called 3 more times while Daniel and I were on the roof. I text her, coming home soon. The phone buzzes back at me almost immediately. I guess she's been waiting for word from me. Been trying to reach you for 2 hours. Sorry, I text back. She always has to have the last word, so I wait for the inevitable reply. So no news then? Hope you didn't get your hopes up. I toss the phone into my backpack without answering. Sometimes I think my mom's worst fear is being disappointed. She combats this by trying her hardest never to get her hopes up and urging everyone else to do the same. It doesn't always work. Once she brought home a casting call flyer for an off-Broadway play for my father. I don't know where she found it or even what the role was. He took it from her and even said thank you, but I'm pretty sure he never called the number. I decide to wait for the final call from Attorney Fitzgerald before saying anything to her. My mom's already dealt with too much disappointment. The trouble with getting your hopes too far up is, it's a long way down.
Samuel Kingsley, A History of Regret, Part 4. Some people are born for greatness. God give a lucky few of us some talent, and then put us on earth to make use of it. Only 2 times in my life I get to use mine. 2 months ago when I did Raisin in the Sun in Manhattan, and 10 years ago when I did it in Montego Bay. There's just something about me and that play that was meant to be. In Jamaica, the Daily called my performance miraculous. I got a standing ovation. Me, not the other actors, me alone. It's a funny thing. That play sent me to America, and now it's sending me back to Jamaica. Patricia asked me how me could tell the cop all our business. Him not no preacher, she say. It not no confession, she say. I tell her I was just drunk and coming off the stage high. The highest thing you can do is the thing God put you on this earth to do. I tell her I didn't mean to do it. And it's true what I tell her. But the opposite true too. Maybe I do it on purpose. This not no confession. I just saying that the thought is there in my mind. Maybe I do it on purpose. We couldn't even fill all the seats in the place. America done with me, and I done with it. More than anything, that night remind me. In Jamaica, I got a standing ovation. In America, I can't get an audience. I don't know. Maybe I do it on purpose. You can get lost in your own mind, like you gone to another country. All your thoughts in another language, and you can't read the signs, even though they're everywhere, all around you.
The first thing I see on his desk is a file with Natasha's name on it. Natasha Kingsley, it says. It has to be her, right? How many Natasha Kingsleys could there be? Not only are our meetings in the same building, but also her lawyer and my interviewer are the same person? The odds have to be astronomical, right? I can't wait to see the look on her face when I tell her. I look up at him and then around the office for other signs. Are you an immigration lawyer? I ask. He looks up from what I presume is my application. I am. Why? I think I know one of your clients, I say, and pick up the file. He snatches it away from me. Don't touch that. It's privileged. He pulls it as far away from me as possible. I grin at Fitzgerald and he frowns back at me. Yeah, sorry, I say. It's just, you saved my life. What are you talking about? He flexes his right wrist and I notice that his hand is bandaged. Now I remember that his paralegal said he'd been in a car accident. I point at the file. I just met her, Natasha, today. He's still frowning at me, not getting it. When I met her, she was being deported. But then she met with you, and you did your lawyer magic, and now she's going to stay. He rests the bandaged hand on his desk. And how did that save your life? She's the one, I say. He frowns. Didn't you say you just met her today? Yep. I can't do anything about the big smile on my face. And she's the one. He doesn't actually put air quotes around the one, but I can hear them in his voice. Vocal air quotes, not better than actual air quotes. He steeples his fingers and stares at me for a good long while. Why are you here? He asks. Is this a trick question? For my admission interview? He looks me over pointedly. No, really. Why are you here in my office right now? You obviously don't care about this interview. You show up here looking like you've been in a brawl. It's a serious question. Why did you come here? There's no way to answer this, but honestly. My parents made me. How old are you? 17. He looks down at my file. It says here that you're interested in the pre-med track. Are you? Not really, I say. Not really or no? Lawyers like certainty. No. Now we're getting somewhere, he says. Do you want to go to Yale? I don't even know if I want to go to college. He leans forward in his chair. I feel like I'm being cross-examined. And what's your big dream? To be a poet. Oh, good, he says. Something practical. Believe it or not, I've heard that one before. He leans in even more. I'll ask you again. Why are you here? I have to be. No, you don't, he fires back. You can just get up and walk out that door. I owe it to my parents. Why? You wouldn't understand. Try me. I sigh. Long-suffering variety. My parents are immigrants. They moved to this country for a better life. They work all the time so my brother and I can have the American dream. Nowhere in the American dream does it say you can skip college and become a starving artist. It says whatever you want it to. I snort. Not in my family, it doesn't. If I don't do this, I get cut off. No funds for college. No nothing. This confession, at least, stops his rapid-fire questioning. He leans back in his chair. Would they really do that? He asks. I know the answer, but I can't make myself say it right away. I think about my dad's face earlier this afternoon. He's so determined that Charlie and I have a better life than he did. He'll do anything to guarantee it. Yes, I say, he would. But not because he's evil, and not because he's a stereotypical Korean parent, but because he can't see past his own history to let us have ours. A lot of people are like that. Fitzgerald whistles low. So I guess you have to be sure the poetry thing is worth it. Now I'm the one leaning in. Haven't you ever done something only because you're obligated to? Just because you made a promise? His eyes drift away from mine. For whatever reason, this question changes the dynamic between us. It feels like we're in the same boat. Meeting your obligations is the definition of adulthood, kid. If you're going to make mistakes and break promises, now's the time. He stops talking, flexes his wrist, and grimaces. Get your screwing up done now, when the consequences aren't so bad. Trust me, it gets harder to do it later. Sometimes people tell you things by not telling you things. I glance at his left hand and see his wedding ring. Is that what happened to you? I ask. He unsteeples his fingers and twists the ring around his finger. I'm a married man with two kids. And you're having an affair with your paralegal. He rubs at the bandage above his eye. It just started today. He looks over to his closed door, as if he's hoping she'll be standing right there. Ended today, too, he says quietly. I didn't actually expect him to admit it, and now I'm not sure what to say. You think I'm a bad guy, he says. I think you're my interviewer, I answer. Maybe it's better for us to just get this interview back on course. He covers his eyes with his hands. I met her too late. I've always had lousy timing. I don't know what to tell him. Not that he's looking to me for advice. Ordinarily, I would say follow your heart. But he's a married man. His heart is not the only one involved. So what are you going to do? Let her go? I ask. He looks at me for a long time, thinking. You're going to have to do the same, he says finally. He pulls Natasha's file from under his elbow. I couldn't do it. I thought I could, but I couldn't. Do what? I ask. Stop her deportation. He's going to have to spell it out for me because I'm not processing what he's saying. Your Natasha is getting deported tonight after all. I couldn't stop it from happening. The judge wouldn't overturn the voluntary removal. I don't know what a voluntary removal is, but all I can think is that there's a mistake. It's definitely a mistake. Now I'm hoping it really is a different Natasha Kingsley. I'm sorry, kid, he says. He slides the file across to me, as if my looking at it is somehow going to help. I flip it open. It's some sort of official form. All I see is her name, Natasha Catherine Kingsley. I didn't know her middle name, Catherine. It suits her. I shut the file and slide it back to him. There has to be something you can do. The finger steeple is back and he shrugs. I've tried everything already. The shrug pisses me off. This is not a small thing. This isn't, oh, you missed your appointment, come again tomorrow. This is Natasha's life, and mine. I stand up. You didn't try hard enough, I accuse him. I'm willing to bet the affair with the secretary has something to do with this. I bet he spent the day breaking promises to his wife and children, and to Natasha, too. Look, I know you're upset. His voice is even, like he's trying to calm me down. But I don't want to be calm. I press my hands into his desk and lean forward. There has to be something you can do. It's not her fault her dad is such a fuck-up. He slides his chair back from the desk. Sorry. Homeland Security doesn't like it if you overstay your visa. But she was just a kid. She didn't have a choice. It's not like she could have said, Mom, Dad, our visa is expired. We should go back to Jamaica now. Doesn't matter. The law has to draw a line somewhere. Their last appeal was denied. The only hope was the judge. If they leave tonight, then there's a slight chance she can reapply for a visa in a few years. But America is her home, I shout. It doesn't matter where she was born. I don't say the rest of it, which is that she belongs with me. I wish there was something I could do, he says. He touches the bandage above his eye again and seems genuinely sorry. Maybe I'm wrong about him. Maybe he really did try. I'm planning on calling her after you and I are done here, he says. After we're done. I've completely forgotten that this meeting is supposed to be about me getting into Yale. You're just going to call her and tell her over the phone? Does it matter how she hears it? He asks, frowning. Of course it matters. I don't want her to hear the worst news of her life over the phone from someone she barely knows. I'll do it, I say. I'll tell her. He shakes his head. I can't let you do that. It's my job. I just sit there not knowing what to do. My lip throbs. The spot on my ribs where Charlie punched me hurts. The place in my heart where Natasha is hurts. I'm sorry, kid, he says again. What if she doesn't get on the plane? What if she just stays? I am desperate. Breaking the law seems a small price to pay to get her to stay. Another head shake. I don't recommend that, as a lawyer or otherwise. I have to get to her and tell her first. I don't want her to be alone when she hears the news. I walk out of his office and into the empty reception area. The paralegal didn't come back. He follows me. So that's it? He asks. No more interview? I don't stop walking. You said it yourself. I don't really care about Yale. He puts a hand on my arm, so I have to turn and face him. Look, I know I said you should get your screwing up done now while you're still a kid, but Yale's a big deal. Going there could open a lot of doors for you. It did for me. And maybe he's right. Maybe I'm being short-sighted. I look around his office. How long will it take for the construction to be done, I wonder? How long will it take for him to hire a new paralegal? I jump my chin in the direction of her desk. You did all the things you were supposed to, and you're still not happy. He rubs again at the bandage above his eye and doesn't look over at the desk. He's tired, but not the kind of tired that sleeping can fix. I tell him, if I don't go now, I'll always regret it. What's another half an hour to finish this interview? He insists. Does he really need me to tell him that all the seconds matter? That our own universe exploded into existence in the space of a breath? Time counts, Mr. Fitzgerald, I tell him. Finally, he turns away from me and looks at the empty desk. But you know that already, I say.
Jeremy Fitzgerald, A Fairy Tale History, Part 2. Jeremy Fitzgerald didn't tell Daniel the truth. The reason he wasn't able to stop Natasha's deportation is that he missed the court appointment with the judge who could have reversed the voluntary removal. he missed it because he's in love with Hannah Winter. And instead of going to see the judge, he spent the afternoon at a hotel with her. Alone in his partially built office, Jeremy will think of Daniel Bay constantly for the next week. He will remember what Daniel said about time counting. He'll remember with perfect clarity Daniel's busted lip and bloodied shirt. He'll remember how that was nothing compared to the complete devastation on Daniel's face when he learned the news about Natasha. Like someone handed him a grenade and exploded his life apart. Sometime in the next month, Jeremy will tell his wife that he no longer loves her, that it will be best for her and the children if he leaves. He will call Hannah Winter, and he will make her promises, and he will keep all of them. His son will never settle down or marry or have children or forgive his father for his betrayal. His daughter will marry her first girlfriend, Marie. She will spend most of that first marriage anticipating and then causing its end. After Marie, no one will ever love her quite as much again. And though she'll get married twice more, she'll never love anyone as much as she did Marie. Jeremy and Hannah's children will grow up to love others in the simple and uncomplicated way of people who have always known where love comes from and aren't afraid of its loss. All of which isn't to say that Jeremy Fitzgerald did the right thing or the wrong thing. It's only to say this. Love always changes everything. Hannah Winter, A Fairy Tale History, Part 2. And they lived happily ever after.
Now that the sun has set, the air's gotten much colder. It's not hard to imagine that winter's just around the corner. I'll have to unearth my bulky black coat and my boots. I tug my jacket closer and contemplate going inside to the lobby where it's warm. I'm on my way in when Daniel walks out the sliding glass doors. He sees me, and I expect a smile. But his face is grim. How badly could his interview have gone? What happened? I ask, as soon as I reach him. I'm imagining the worst, like he got into a fight with his interviewer, and now he's banned from applying to any college at all, and his future is ruined. He puts his hand on my face. I really love you, he says. He's not joking. This has nothing to do with our silly bet. He says it the way you would say it to someone who is dying, or you don't expect to see again. Daniel, what's wrong? I pull his hand away from my face, but I hold on to it. I love you, he says again, and recaptures my face with his other hand. It doesn't matter if you say it back. I just want you to know it. My phone rings. It's the lawyer's office. Don't answer it, he says. Of course I'm going to answer it. He touches my hand to stop me. Please don't, he says again. Now I'm alarmed. I click ignore. What happened to you in there? He squeezes his eyes shut. When he opens them again, they're filled with tears.
You can't stay here, he says.
At first I don't get it. Why? Is the building closing for the night? I look around for guards asking us to leave. Tears slide down his cheeks. Certain and unwanted knowledge blooms in my mind. I pull my hand out of his. What was your interviewer's name? I whisper. He's nodding now.
My interviewer was your lawyer.
Fitzgerald?
Yes, he says.
I pull out my phone and look at the number again, still refusing to understand what he's telling me. I've been waiting for him to call. Did he say something about me? I already know the answer. I know it. It takes him a couple